This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, June 16, 2009. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda. Iran's government limits press freedom as protests continue over the recent election results. In the US Congress, IMF funding gets in the way of war spending. And we go to India's Kashmir region, where the rape of two young women has ignited ethnic tensions. All these stories and more after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A New York State Supreme Court judge said today he won't settle the state Senate's power dispute. Justice Thomas McNamara says lawmakers should settle the matter themselves. New York Governor David Paterson says he'll take the gavel and run the chamber himself to move important legislation through. Last week, two dissident Democrats defected and gave the state's Republicans a majority. Senate lawmakers have been unable to negotiate a power-sharing agreement since the coup. 11 days after demonstrations by Amazonian indigenous people turned violent, leaving at least 34 protesters and police dead, Peru's prime minister has signed a pact with tribal leaders. Pamela Cueva reports.
Prime Minister Yehude Simons has announced that the government will send a bill to the National Congress by Thursday that would revoke the laws that ignited the confrontation. The 1090 and 1064 decrees would open more than 50% of the Amazonian forest to mining, oil, and gas exploration. They were passed as part of an effort to establish a free trade agreement with the United States. Simons apologized to the Amazonian delegates for the deaths and acknowledged that the government did not repeal the decrees when they had originally promised to do so. Finally, he announced he will resign his position after the negotiations are finished.
We will come to the table tomorrow, meaning that we will accept the requests of the indigenous people who consider these pressing matters. They suggest overturning a legislative decree, 1090 and 1064, which we, as the commission, have accepted because it represents the voice of the majority.
For FSRN, I'm Pamela Cueva with Alfredo Cuadros Lima.
The National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs said today that murders with a motive based on sexual orientation bias were up 28% in 2008 over the previous year. In its annual report, the National Advocacy Group said overall bias-based violence was up 2%. UN observers are pulling out of the breakaway Republic of Abkhazia today after Russia vetoed an extension of their mission during a vote at the UN Security Council. Jacob Resnick reports.
The 16-year-old observer mission has been overseeing a ceasefire between Georgia and the rebel region, which fought a war for independence in the early 90s. Russia and Nicaragua recognized Abkhazia's independence following last August's war between Georgia and Russia. Speaking on the eve of the UN vote, Abkhazian Foreign Minister Sergei Shamba said the UN must recognize that Abkhazia is no longer part of Georgia. The UN mission head told reporters he fears for the future of the 60,000 ethnic Georgians living in Abkhazia now that observers are leaving. But Foreign Minister Shamba says peace is still possible.
Of course, in the future, we will have to negotiate in order to live peacefully together within this territory. The conflict that took place here was the result of Georgia's desire to control our territory.
The fate of this UN mission is similar to that of OSCE observers that have been monitoring the border between Georgia and the breakaway Republic of South Ossetia, which Russia also vetoed. The OSCE has until the end of the month to withdraw. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Abkhazia.
Nearly 10,000 Central American migrants have been kidnapped over a recent six-month period while crossing through Mexico on their way to the United States. Shannon Young has more.
A survey conducted by Mexico's National Human Rights Commission found an average of 50 migrants a day were kidnapped from September 2008 to February 2009. The main perpetrator is organized crime, but the commission also documented widespread police participation. Central American migrants in Mexico are particularly vulnerable to attack because many follow predetermined routes, sleep in the open and isolated areas, and purposely avoid contact with Mexican authorities. Kidnappers force captured migrants to call relatives to pay their ransoms via wire transfer. Victims whose ransoms are not paid quickly frequently suffer physical and sexual abuse. With the average ransom at $2,500, Mexico's Human Rights Commission estimates migrant kidnappers made at least $25 million in 6 months. But those figures come from just the documented cases. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
After losing half of its parliamentary seats in recent national elections, the Marxist Communist Party of India now faces a new challenge in West Bengal, a state it has ruled for more than two decades. Maoist militants, backed by thousands of villagers, took over the Lalgarh area of the state on Monday, setting fire to several police stations and political offices. Most of the Communist Party members have fled the area, and the Maoists are now demolishing their houses. The rebels say the attacks are spontaneous public reaction to police atrocities. And in India's northeastern state of Assam today, tribal militants killed at least 12 people. Bismila Gilani has the details.
The incident occurred in the North Kachar Hills district of Assam, where a group of heavily armed militants belonging to the Dima Halam Dauga group attacked a minority Naga tribe. Authorities say the militants first torched their huts and then opened indiscriminate fire on the fleeing villagers, killing 12 on the spot. Among the dead are 8 children and 2 women. The Dima Halam Dauga group, also known as the Black Widow group, has been fighting since 1995 for a separate homeland for Assam's Dimasa tribe. The police say the group has killed more than 50 people in the area in the past 3 months. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
As protests continue over Iran's disputed presidential election results, Iranian authorities are clamping down on freedom of expression. Dozens of people have been arrested, and clashes between supporters of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and opposition leader Mir Hossein Mousavi have left at least 7 people dead. The powerful Guardian Council has approved a partial recount of the votes, as opposition leaders blame President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad of winning rigged elections. Meanwhile, local authorities have cancelled accreditation of foreign journalists covering the protests, limiting them to working from their offices. We're on the line now with Mohammed Abdel Dayem, the Middle East Director for the Committee to Protect Journalists. Thanks for joining us, Mohammed.
Sure, my pleasure.
Now, we've heard that foreign journalists aren't allowed to report from the field in Iran. Could you tell us a bit more about what the situation is right now?
Yes, that is in fact correct. The Iranian ministry that handles foreign reporters has in fact sent a message to all foreign reporters in the country telling them that they may only report from their offices, they may conduct phone interviews, and they are not to attend any news events that have not been announced by the ministry. If they want to do that, they first have to get written permission from the ministry.
So that would apply for photographers also, camera crews?
Absolutely.
Now, what about the situation for local journalists? Are they facing any sort of restrictions?
The situation for local journalists is even worse. They do not get the exposure that international journalists get when they are roughed up or beaten in a street demonstration. There are many reports, unfortunately, most of which are unconfirmed. And we're in the process of trying to confirm some of these reports that, you know, up to a dozen Iranian journalists, local Iranian journalists writing for local publications have been detained. Some were detained and released a day or two before the election. A few more were detained and released on the day of the election. And since then, a couple of more have been reported missing. And it's not clear if these people have been detained by the authorities or if they've gone into hiding because of the type of reporting that they've conducted.
Does this commonly happen in Iran? Does the government take measures to limit the freedom of the media in Iran, or is this a very exceptional type of situation?
Well, I think that the Iranian government and Iranian censors frequently interfere with the free flow of information and frequently censor journalists, especially local journalists, much more so than international journalists.
Is there a sort of struggle in Iran between the government and the press, as there may be in other countries where perhaps the press is not aligned with the government?
In any healthy society, there's an adversarial relationship between the government and the press, of one of whose functions is to monitor the government and the way it operates. I think that adversarial relationship is reduced in Iran because it's a country where throughout the 1990s, upward of 100 publications have been shut down by the government during that decade, the decade of the 90s. And so the number of reformist publications that you see in Iran today has shrunk considerably. There is definitely an adversarial relationship between opposition newspapers or reformist newspapers and this conservative government. But I think that tension has been reduced significantly as the number of those publications has dwindled down.
Coming back to the current situation, have you observed any limitations to other forms of freedom of expression besides journalism?
Well, yes. I mean, obviously, people have been told that these congregations and these demonstrations are illegal and that they're not authorized by the government, and that anybody who goes out to demonstrate is in violation of the law. So these hundreds of thousands of people that we saw in Tehran yesterday and again today and in smaller crowds in some of the other cities of Iran, technically, as far as the government is concerned, are in violation of the law. So that in and of itself is a violation of their right to assemble and their right to express themselves. But more directly, if we go back to media for a second, a number of news organizations have explicitly been told to leave the country. A Dutch broadcaster, as well as a Dutch government broadcaster, as well as a Belgian broadcaster, as well as a Spanish broadcaster, have had their equipment confiscated and or destroyed in varying cases, and have all been told to leave the country immediately.
That was Mohammed Abdel Dayem from the International Committee to Protect Journalists. To hear our full interview, you can go to our website, fsrn.org. You'll hear how Iranians are using social networking sites like Twitter to get around the media restrictions. The U.S. Congress is preparing to vote for a $100 billion war spending bill for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. While some liberal members refuse to vote for another war funding bill, it's funding for the International Monetary Fund that is proving to be problematic for the bill's passage. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
The $98 billion war supplemental embodies a shift in war policy. Most of the money will go to draw down the troops in Iraq and build up combat forces in Afghanistan and along the Pakistan border. But President Obama is having a difficult time rallying support on the Hill, this despite an intense campaign he and his aides are putting on members of Congress. For the persuadable, some changes to the war supplemental were made. Money to close Guantanamo Bay was stripped. So was a provision that barred the release of detainee abuse photos. Language was added so detainees will not be transferred to the United States without the president first presenting a plan. That worked for some. But many on the right and on the left are aligning in opposition. They express concern over an additional $108 billion for the International Monetary Fund. Because it is so controversial, the administration wanted it included in a war funding bill, assuming lawmakers would be forced to support it, forced to support the troops. But that's proving difficult.
I want them to separate IMF from the defense funding.
That was Liberal Democrat Lynn Woolsey of California. Her remarks echo the sentiment of Republican Phil Gingrey of Georgia.
We ought to keep this funding strictly to war funding as much as possible.
$100 billion for the IMF fulfills a pledge President Obama made at the G20 conference to increase IMF aid by $500 billion. It would be used to help middle-income countries, especially in Europe, such as Greece, Ireland, and Hungary, get through the global financial crisis. Desmond Lachman is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank in Washington, D.C. He used to work at the IMF and supports the funding. He says his proposal would help countries avoid national bankruptcy, which the world witnessed at the height of the financial meltdown last year.
You know, we saw what happened when we had Iceland, a small country like Iceland last year, when it had a very large devaluation and when it had very disruptive domestic conditions that had impact on global markets.
But Mark Weisbrot, co-director at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, says the loans would not be used as a stimulus for struggling countries. Instead, he says the countries would receive the money to repay large financial institutions.
We can already see in countries like Latvia, for example, where the IMF is loaning them money on the condition that they keep their pegged exchange rate, that it's designed to bail out the Swedish banks that have loans there.
Advocates, including Democratic leadership and the administration, say paying back banks is precisely what will help contain the spread of more financial instability. Members of Congress opposed to the IMF proposal in the supplemental want it to be a separate bill to receive a full debate. The House of Representatives is expected to vote on the war and IMF supplemental Tuesday evening. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
The Obama administration has released a sweeping new assessment of the impacts of climate change in the United States. From Pacifica Station KPFA, Brian Edwards Tiekert has more.
The new report is blunt. It says there's no question that global warming is happening, that people are causing it, that it's changing our climate, and that it's going to get much worse. In the United States, it says, the impacts will cut into water supplies, lower crop production, spread tropical diseases, and cause more severe storms and floods. John Holdren, Barack Obama's chief science advisor, used a map to show the parts of Florida he expects to be underwater by the end of the century.
The Florida Keys, Everglades National Park in the south, much of the Cape Canaveral area in the east, and the barrier islands, such as those in the Sanibel area on the west coast.
The new climate report comes as Congress fights over a massive bill that would impose the nation's first cap on greenhouse gas emissions. Jane Lubchenco is administrator of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
I think that much of the foot dragging in addressing climate change is a reflection of the perception that climate change is way down the road, it's in the future, and that it only affects remote parts of the planet. And this report demonstrates, provides the concrete scientific information that says unequivocally that climate change is happening now, and it's happening in our own backyards, and it affects the kinds of things people care about.
The 196-page report is the first national climate assessment since 2000, when government scientists issued a report they'd been drafting under the Clinton administration. Some government scientists say Bush administration officials directed agency staff to ignore that report's conclusions, and when the government didn't issue a follow-up report 4 years later, environmental groups sued. The new report includes region-by-region breakouts of expected global warming impacts in the United States. It's available online at globalchange.gov. Brian Edwards Tiekert, FSRN, Berkeley.
Today, the House Subcommittee on Government Oversight and Investigations held a hearing on health insurance rescission. That's the practice of retroactively canceling individual health care policies by insurance companies. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
3 days before Robin Beaton was scheduled to have a double mastectomy for cancer, she heard from her insurance company.
Blue Cross and Blue Shield called me by telephone and told me that my chart was red flagged.
Beaton says they ended up canceling her insurance.
Can you imagine having to walk around with cancer growing in your body with no insurance? It's the most terrible thing in the world to not have anybody to turn to, not have anywhere to go. So just can't even say how bad it was.
Beaton, a former nurse, had retired and started her own business. She had bought a private policy and was up to date on her premiums. But when the insurance company discovered she had cancer, Beaton says they told her there was some incorrect information on her application. They ended the policy. Again, Beaton.
Blue Cross and Blue Shield has control over life and over death. Sad fact is anyone with a catastrophic illness who is not a part of a group who has an individual policy stands a really high chance of getting canceled.
Insurance companies say rescission, or the practice of canceling a policy, is a way to weed out fraudulent claims. Brian Sassy is a president of the healthcare insurance provider WellPoint.
Rescission is a tool employed by WellPoint and other health insurers to protect the vast majority of policyholders who provide accurate and complete information from subsidizing the cost of those who do not. The bottom line is that rescission is about combating costs driven by these issues. If we fail to address fraud and material misrepresentation, the cost of coverage would increase, making coverage less affordable for existing and future individual policyholders.
At the hearing, Representative Henry Waxman said insurance companies were quick to award policies to get premiums, but they were equally quick to cancel the policies.
That when people with individual policies become ill and then they submit their claims for expensive treatments, then insurance companies launch an investigation. They scour the policyholder's original insurance application and the person's medical records to find any discrepancy, any omission, or any misstatement that could allow them to cancel the policy.
Wendy Horton had her insurance canceled as well. She says there are long-term effects.
The worst part about my rescission is that I have been unable to get insurance anywhere else. I applied for individual insurance through Blue Shield, but on their application, they ask if the applicant has ever had insurance rescinded. When they learned that I had, they informed me that they would not accept me for coverage. Every insurance company asks if you've ever had health care coverage rescinded. For the rest of my life, I will never be able to get individual coverage again because of Blue Cross.
Last year, the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform launched an investigation into individual health insurance policies. The committee received approximately 116,000 pages of documents and interviewed numerous policyholders who had their coverage terminated or rescinded after they became ill. Karen Miller, FSRN, Washington.
In Indian-administered Kashmir, protests continue as well as battles between police and civilians. The rape and murder of two Kashmiri women continues to bring people out on the streets, and the government has responded with bullets and undeclared curfews. Civilians are reporting excessive use of force. From Srinagar, Shanawaz Khan reports.
For the first week of this month, everything was shut down in Kashmir. Police and protesters fought each other with stones and tear gas, injuring more than 600 people. One man, Nisar Ahmed, died from a tear gas injury to his head. Police then attacked Ahmed's funeral with tear gas, forcing his relatives to carry his coffin amid the nauseating gas. The latest spell of violence began after a teenage girl and her pregnant sister-in-law were raped and killed, and the bodies were found near one of the camps of Indian paramilitary troops. The locals accused the Indian security forces of the crime, and when the civilians protested, police and troops took control of the streets. Shabir Amadar is a resident of Srinagar.
When people came out to protest the killing of two women, police were out in force. They were on every street and at crossings. And wherever they smelled a protest, they would quell it with tear gas and firing. 400 people were injured. Even prayers were not allowed at times.
Protests and street battles with police are not new in Kashmir, where, since 1989, police have brutally suppressed the vocal movement for a separate homeland. The huge deployment of Indian security forces, with an estimated ratio of one soldier per family, has resulted in the civilians complaining about gross human rights violations. To stop the increasing protests, the state has started imposing undeclared curfews.
We were sitting inside our house when the men in uniform came into our neighborhood. They hurled rocks at our houses. They broke windows in the gate too. They damaged many houses in the neighborhood.
Special laws like the Armed Forces Special Powers Act and Disturbed Areas Act provide troops with unbridled powers and impunity. Legal experts, however, say that undeclared curfews and unwarranted force on the civilians are against the principles in the Constitution. Zafar Shah is a senior advocate at the High Court of Indian Administered Kashmir.
The government has no power to impose curfew unless a formal order to this effect is issued under law. This, in my opinion, is clearly unconstitutional and illegal.
Apart from curfews and restrictions, the authorities also arrested a number of separatists, including hardliner Saeed Ali Gilani. Gilani had called for a general strike against the government over the latest rape and murder incident.
The government has also been detaining various leaders. Now, there is no law under which they have been detained. They are asked to stay inside their own residential houses, and police personnel are posted in and around their houses. They can't leave their houses. The government does not act in the state in accordance with their own laws, whatever their nature and quality of those laws is.
Many times, police and troops use excessive force. Residents frequently accuse them of beating pedestrians and barging into residential houses. Dr. Zameer is a resident of Memandar Shpain.
When we leave the house in the morning, we find troops at our door and in the street. They tell us we can't go out. We understand it is an undeclared curfew. It's undeclared to avoid international attention. If someone insists on coming out, they beat him or her up, sometimes without any provocation, too.
Initially, the government lied. When the bodies of two young women were found on May 30, officials said the women drowned. But the medical report established both were raped and killed. After huge protests, the government initiated a judicial probe to investigate the deaths. The Judicial Commission is expected to deliver its report next month. Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Kashmir.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. We podcast at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. Today's newscast was produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. Headlines editor is Nell Abram, and the technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi and Puck Lowe. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda.